One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Tortoise. It's July 2019, a warm evening on the banks of the River Thames in London, and the Confederation of British Industry, Britain's biggest business lobby group, is holding its summer work party. Everyone's excited. The CBI is full of young people in their 20s and 30s, and they've been looking forward to this party for weeks. They're keen to let off steam after working flat out on the drama of Brexit.
The government was doing crazy things like announcing trade deals one minute and then something else the next. Then the general election was announced. It was crazy times.
Normally, the CBI holds its annual party at Christmas, but this year they've opted for a summer event. And they've gone all out. A boat party on the Tattershall Castle, a navy boat with a large red and white funnel. It's moored off the Victoria Embankment, just opposite the London Eye, a stone's throw away from the heart of British politics.
The CBI was big on fancy dress. Everybody loves it and goes all out with the costumes. It was absolutely unreal. A legendary CBI story was when Carolyn dressed up as Snow White once. We decided that the boat party would be Hawaiian themed, so people came in Hawaiian t-shirts.
Most of the senior team drift off after the CBI's Director General, Carolyn Fairbairn, gives a brief speech congratulating them for all their hard work. As the sun sets over Whitehall, the party gets going. Queues form at the bar. There's not much food on offer, so as you might expect, some staff are getting drunk. The dancing starts. There's one man in his 20s who's definitely had too much to drink. He's falling about, dancing too closely to people. Several people, including some in HR, are watching. The man's behaviour that night will lead to the end of his short-lived career at the CBI. Senior management is informed of the incident and he's dismissed the day after. In the aftermath of the party, the CBI's executive committee acknowledges that things got a bit out of hand. It's decided that a boat party without much food maybe wasn't the best call. The organisation will return to sit-down dinners from now on. After that, most think nothing more of that night. Until years later, when a story emerges containing an allegation of something else that happened on board the Tattershall Castle that night. A young woman, reportedly held in a bathroom and raped by a senior manager. And the CBI's response to this allegation brings the organisation to its knees. This is a story about how not to handle a crisis. It's about reputations, fairness, media storms, and double standards.
The problem for the CBI was it was an institution which preached about best practice, diversity and inclusion, inclusive workspaces, promoting women and mental health. And if you're going to do that, you have to be the model employer.
This week, reporter Barney McIntyre and producer Rebecca Moore take you inside an organisation that, on the one hand, thrives in the public eye, but on the other, is a vault of secrets. Last spring, those secrets came spilling out, the dirty laundry on show for everyone to see. The CBI crisis became all the things that people quietly dread about the workplace. the cringeworthy staff parties.
And I walked around the party saying, who wants to come to karaoke?
Overly friendly managers.
Tony wants to be the chummy boss.
Office cliques.
The Tony defenders felt the CBI was under attack.
Arse covering boards.
My theory is I think they panicked and felt they had to do something. And the only thing they could think of doing was to ask me to go.
But most importantly, about a place that, at one point, felt unsafe for young women.
Women were asking, you know, do these individuals still work here?
Over to Barney.
I'm delighted to welcome back. The Prime Minister has been here at every conference since 2010. Please, a very, very warm welcome for the Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, David Cameron. Thank you.
Well, morning, everyone. Great to be here. Great to be back, as you said. Never one to miss.
I want to begin with a massive thank you to the CBI for keeping going during the last 18 months, 2 years, for looking after your...
That we will continue to take the long-term decisions that are necessary to ensure that we maintain our hard-won stability. We will take no risks. There will be no irresponsible...
The CBI is a valued institution in this country and a powerful voice for business.
The CBI has historically been the voice of UK business. A synapse carrying messages between the city and Westminster, a union of sorts for employers to make their case to government. At points it has represented more than 190,000 UK businesses, which between them employed nearly 7 million people.
I think they had an amazing brand. Where else could you just ring up and get a meeting with a minister next week? What other jobs do you get to go and just meet with executives of the FTSE 100? And brief them when you're in your mid-20s.
It had a reputation. Clever, connected, and when it needed to be, pugnacious. But the fight was never an existential one. Until last spring, when, in the process of handling a barrage of bad press, the CBI turned on itself. It splintered into factions, each with a different version of events and a different worldview. All of a sudden, an organisation which prided itself on setting a standard for workplaces dissolved into allegations, investigations and trashed reputations. Scandal, shame, sackings and panic in the boardroom. Its boss was fired, along with three senior managers for unknown reasons. Dozens of companies dropped their membership. The government and politicians of all stripes cut ties. A £3 million bailout was required. Before long, the chair of the board left prematurely. So did four other board members. The chair and the CEO, known in CBI parlance as the president and the director general, had a fight on BBC Radio, slagging each other off in front of millions. The fired boss settled an unfair dismissal case with the CBI and signed an NDA, in other words, a gagging order. A former CBI president was pushed off the boards of two of Britain's biggest companies, Tesco and Barrett's. Multiple NDAs were signed by staff, and another lawsuit was settled. Nearly 100 people lost their jobs. The CBI nearly went bankrupt. The news stories that precipitated the CBI's fall from grace were about a range of behaviours. From inviting staff to a karaoke party, to viewing junior colleagues' social media, to allegations of touching, to two far more serious allegations of rape. These alleged incidents spanned years, but they all emerged at once, partly ushered into the public sphere by a group of campaigning staff. In the rush to apportion blame and be seen to do right, CBI leaders responded with a one-size-fits-all approach. Apologise first, investigate later. Due process went out the window. It's March 2023, and staff at the CBI are gearing up for one of the crunch moments in the calendar, the spring budget. 2 weeks before the Chancellor is due to bring out his red box, the comms team gets an email. It's from a journalist at The Guardian, Anna Isaac. She says she's about to publish a number of allegations about the head of the CBI.
Mr. Grove, our Director General, Tony Danker.
At this point, Tony Danker has been in charge of the CBI for 2.5 years.
This is a really exciting opportunity for me at a really important time for the country. And so, to be honest, it was a no-brainer when asked to do this role.
He's a loud and affable Northern Irishman who worked in strategy for The Guardian and founded the lobby group Be The Business. He has a degree from Harvard and has done stints at McKinsey and the Treasury as a special advisor. It's fair to say he enjoys being at the centre of things.
Good evening, everybody. Secretary Kerry, Business Secretary Kwarteng, our good friend Kwasi, Secretaries of State also with us. Ministers from near and far, distinguished guests, leaders of business, welcome to the CBI's COP26 dinner.
The allegations against him are potentially explosive. Anna Isaac says a female CBI employee reported Tony Danker for making unwanted contact, which she considered to be sexual harassment. It concerned a comment made by Tony Danker to the woman in the open plan office above Cannon Street Station. Words to the effect of, "I had a dream about us singing karaoke together." The Guardian also alleges he sent the same woman a barrage of unwanted messages, some featuring sexually suggestive language, over more than a year. The paper alleges he was proactively searching for staff members on Instagram, people he did not follow himself. It adds that he's been taking junior staff to one-on-one breakfasts and lunches. In a statement, Tony Danker said, "It's been mortifying to hear that I have caused offence or anxiety to any colleague. It was completely unintentional and I apologise profusely." It's important to understand the context here. Tony Danker took over running of the CBI in November 2020, 8 months into the COVID pandemic. Full disclosure, at this time, Tortoise was working with the CBI on online seminars during lockdown. COVID was a game changer for bosses. With many employees working from home, some managers took it upon themselves to get to know their staff better, to ask how they were coping. Remember those awkward moments at the beginning of a Zoom call, the obligatory, "And what did you watch on Netflix this weekend?" Gone were the old ways. The CEO in the corner office, aloof and too busy or important to know your name, let alone the name of your cat. And this radical new way of doing things suited Tony Danker to a T. He seemed to enjoy getting to know his staff. Tony Danker says that the week he joined, he sent a message on Microsoft Teams to every single member of staff individually.
"I sent people, junior staff, loads of messages on Teams, very often talking about non-work stuff. I have on Teams messaged probably 200 people to say, 'Hi, how are you? How was your weekend? Show me pictures of your dogs or your babies.'"
But he was freestyling. He didn't know how this new contract between employees and bosses was supposed to work. Some people found it odd.
"And so what's happened here, obviously, is that some people have received these messages and gone, 'This is totally inappropriate.' And they haven't realised that I've been doing this to everyone to try and build rapport."
And then he strayed into really tricky territory. Social media.
"To not even follow you, so to navigate to your page, looking at your private life, I'm sorry, that's a bit crazy."
This is a young woman who worked for the CBI at the time. She didn't want to be identified, so we're calling her Charlotte, and an actor is reading her words.
"Imagine being those young members of staff and having not just your boss, but your boss's boss looking at your stories. It just makes me uncomfortable."
According to Charlotte, Tony Danker repeatedly looked up employees on Instagram and watched their stories. That's their daily photograph, which disappears after 24 hours. He would go on to speak about this during a radio interview a few weeks later.
"And during the pandemic and beyond, I viewed the stories and profiles of a very small number of CBI staff, men and women, who have public Instagram profiles, not private ones, public, so they broadcast to the world. Nobody complained, but the investigator raised with me, and the CBI already knew, that some people thought that that was intrusive. And I get that."
Listening to that, I'm struck by how he still seems to be figuring out where the line sits when engaging with your employees. Stumbling over this intergenerational faux pas. Instagram isn't like Twitter or LinkedIn. Your account might be public, but the underlying assumption is that it's for your friends and family, not for work, and usually not for your boss's eyes. Some people told us this was Tony Danker's way of finding common ground. They admitted it was a bit embarrassing, a digital equivalent of dad dancing.
"I think Tony wanted to be the chummy boss, the cool boss who can chat to everyone."
To be clear, it's not illegal to look at someone's Instagram story, and there's nothing in Instagram's small print saying it's not for use at work or by your boss. This is about reading the room, the electronic room, in which, we assume, Tony Danker didn't know his staff knew he was looking at their stories. And there's another important part of the context as it relates to Tony Danker. Who he took over from.
Tony, when he came in, took the complete opposite approach to management from Carolyn. Carolyn would stay remote from the staff, sometimes trying to meet her was like trying to meet the Pope. It's not that she doesn't like to talk to the staff and walk around the floor chatting, but it was quite clear that it was her senior team that would have the most contact with her. He wanted to create a culture of like, there's no hierarchy here, we're all just people. I'm just going to hang out with you and join your team meetings and just message people on Teams and stuff. So already that was a big shock for CBI staff who were used to Carolyn's more detached, traditional management style.
It's hard to overstate just how big of a deal Carolyn Fairbairn was, especially during the Brexit years. A veteran of business who had unparalleled access. She would go on air day in, day out and be scathing about the possibility of a no-deal Brexit.
Businesses are extraordinarily anxious right now. So 100 days next week on Wednesday until we leave, and firms still have no clarity about how no deal would be avoided.
Tony Danker's style was more approachable. But sometimes that blurred a line. There's the bizarre karaoke comment. I had a dream about a singing karaoke. While investigating this story, my producer Rebecca and I have been surprised at how much karaoke comes up. It seems to be Tony's way of marking himself out as a fun boss. The first karaoke event, under his leadership, took place at COP26 in November 2021. Participants included Tony Danker, Chief Economist Rae Newton-Smith, and former President Lord Billimoria. Along with 30 other staff members, they'd had a brilliant evening singing together into the night. It had been a hit. Everyone talked about it in the office. A month later, at the staff Christmas party, a source who was there told us Tony Danker was keen to repeat the success. He walked around the party, encouraging staff to attend an after-party at a karaoke bar in Soho.
Everybody was walking around saying, let's go to karaoke. And I said, okay. And I booked a room for 15 people, was the largest I could get. And I walked around the party saying, who wants to come to karaoke? And we got 15 people, and we went.
Roughly 9 women and 7 men attended. It would later be characterised in the press as Tony Danker having invited out mostly women under the age of 35. There's a picture here, it seems to me. A picture of a boss who wants to connect with his staff, but without any insight in how it might play in the office, especially if you weren't part of the karaoke gang. This is someone we're calling Grace. She worked for the CBI in 2023 at the time of the allegations. She was in her 20s and held a mid-rank position at the CBI.
Everyone gossiped about the karaoke parties and Instagram stories, the invite list.
The allegations in Anna Isaac's article were more reputationally damaging than just a cliquey night at karaoke. The board's job was to protect that reputation. They meet that weekend. There are heavy hitters in the room. There's Dame Vivian Hunt, a senior partner at McKinsey, Claire Barclay, the head of Microsoft in the UK, Anna Marks, the global chair at Deloitte, Lord Karen Billimoria, the founder of Cobra Beer. These people have busy day jobs and decades of experience at the highest levels of business. The CBI's president, who also sits on the board, was Brian McBride, a white-haired Glaswegian who started his career selling photocopiers and went on to become CEO of Amazon UK. He's the only director who isn't completely blindsided. He explains to the board that a woman working at the CBI did complain about Tony Danker's dream comment back in January. The woman did not, however, mention any of the sexually suggestive messages she had allegedly received from Tony Danker, or their frequency. Brian McBride ordered an internal investigation to be run by the CBI's head of HR. The report ultimately concluded that it did not require escalation to a disciplinary process. But the problem that The Guardian will focus on is the way that complaint was dealt with, because HR, ultimately, reports to Tony Danker. Brian McBride could have hired an independent investigator to look into the claim about the CBI boss. He didn't. It's not a grievous error, but the optics aren't good. The board agrees on a course of action to contain the problem. Tony Danker will step aside, temporarily on full pay, while an independent law firm investigates. Sources who spoke with board members at the time told us they were confident Tony Danker could weather the storm and be reappointed. After all, it wasn't the complainant herself who went to the press. She said she was satisfied with the CBI's internal investigation and Tony Danker's apology. Taking the matter to the press was reportedly against her wishes. But there were people who felt that the story needed to be told. Publicly. A group of women, who at one point all worked for the CBI's Brexit team, felt uncomfortable with Tony Danker's management style. We approached these women, but they didn't reply, so we have chosen not to name them on the assumption that they wish to remain anonymous. They had been high flyers, working under Carolyn Fairbairn on the hottest topic of the day, Brexit. When Tony Danker arrived, he restructured the CBI. The Brexit team was disbanded and the strategy changed. Leaders judged the CBI's hardcore Remain stance had to be toned down if it wanted to have the ear of Boris Johnson's government. By this point, the women from the Brexit team had gone separate ways, and one left the CBI. Each, we're told, felt hard done by for different reasons. Sources told us one of them had raised an HR complaint about the boss in 2022, that he had been viewing her Instagram on multiple occasions without following her. She felt the complaint had been mishandled and decided to sue the CBI, eventually winning a settlement. Another had received a comment about her dress suiting her figure from an ex-CBI board member. The third woman remained at the CBI throughout the crisis, having moved out of a role on the high-status Brexit team. I'm telling you all this because these are the cracks in the ice that formed before an avalanche. Sources tell us that all three felt aggrieved by what they saw as an unfair outcome of their friend's complaint and Tony Danker's conduct, and encouraged other young staff to speak up. They reached out to people at the organisation asking if they had any HR complaints. They contacted journalists and former board members. In their eyes, it was justice, breaking the silence, righting the ship. But to certain staff, especially management, it was a betrayal of the CBI. On Monday, March the 6th, The Guardian publishes its story. And if the first mistake the CBI makes is to not use an external company to investigate Tony Danker, what the senior leadership does next is the second. Brian McBride sends out an internal email to all staff. He shares a link for anonymous complaints, but also encourages staff not to discuss any complaints or queries about the investigation with journalists. Here's Grace again.
I only had good experiences there, and I'd like that written in. After the initial allegations were made, it became clear that leadership were not capable of dealing with this properly. There was a lot of emotion, and there was this feeling of victimhood and persecution. And it was very clear that some of the senior leadership saw the whistleblower as an enemy, as someone that was trying to bring them down. The thought being, they weren't whistleblowers because they went to The Guardian. They somehow had an agenda.
Grace describes how almost immediately after The Guardian publishes its first article into Tony Danker, a divide solidified within the CBI. An us versus them situation between this group of current and former staff and the management. Some of it was coloured by differences of political opinion, age and gender. Mostly, it was about personalities clashing in a high-stakes environment, each with their own version of the truth.
One senior manager said to me, "I know Tony is a good man. You need to go out and you need to act and you need to tell people to stop talking and you need to make sure that people know that we support Tony." I was so shocked by that, that they were asking me because I was well networked within the organisation to essentially act as a propaganda piece.
The mood in the office became bleak for those caught in the crossfire.
It was a very shocking time and deeply sad. There was always a very good community with colleagues. And suddenly, everything became embattled. There was a kind of feeling of unreality, moving from a very warm, welcoming environment to suspicion.
An outward-looking organisation was beginning to turn in on itself.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
On the 3rd of April, nearly a month after the claims about Tony Danker, the CBI is rocked again. Another story by Anna Isaac in The Guardian. The headline: new claims of sexual misconduct and toxic culture at the CBI. More than a dozen women who worked or had worked at the CBI had apparently gone to the press to tell their stories. These new allegations had nothing to do with Tony Danker. Instead, the article contained a swathe of allegations relating to offence before his time, some of them criminal. They included claims that a senior manager sent explicit images to junior staff, that a former board member touched an employee's bottom, that there was widespread use of cocaine at CBI events, and that there was, in general, a toxic culture of misogyny and unchecked misconduct at the organisation. Most strikingly, the story contained testimony from the woman who said she was raped at the boat party in 2019. It says the woman went to a senior manager at the CBI and told them she had been raped by a colleague. She expected that manager to support her through what she knew would be an arduous process involving HR and ultimately the police. But this is not what happened. Instead, the manager warned her of the impact such a serious allegation could have on the person she was accusing and advised her to seek counselling. It's a response that raises serious questions about the culture of an organisation that claimed it placed a strong emphasis on transparency, good work, and the safety of its employees. What to make of the sheer number of claims? Staff were circumventing their line managers and the HR department and going straight to a newspaper. It's the nuclear option, and it says a lot about how staff felt whistleblowers were being treated. The Guardian article is published at midday. When CBI staff read it, many openly cry in the office, including senior members of staff. For the board, this is a reputational bomb. The allegations about Tony Danker are one thing, but the allegations in this second article paint a picture of a rotten organisation. The CBI board knows it needs to act decisively. Other organisations have been sunk for less. At 2 p.m. that day, the board holds an emergency meeting online. People dial in from all over the world. It's Easter weekend and many of them are on holiday. They were overwhelmed and in the dark about the veracity of these new claims. The board decides to fire Tony Danker. Karen Billimoria, board member and vice president at the time, said the decision to remove Tony Danker from his position was reached in 5 minutes. He added, "I'm not sure how much quicker we could realistically have been." The following day, the Saturday, they choose to appoint Rayne Newton-Smith, former chief economist at the CBI, who'd just taken a job at Barclays. She'd run against Tony Danker for the job previously, but people criticised the process. After calling around for advice, she agrees to take on the role. On Tuesday, Tony Danker is informed of his dismissal. He tweets he is shocked. Fox Williams, the employment law firm which the board hired previously to look into allegations about Tony Danker, is brought back in. Its task is to look at what was known within the CBI about these new allegations. That's now the third investigation. Two external, one internal. People with knowledge of the board's process told me that several directors were more concerned about their own reputations and the companies they ran than with taking a thorough and forensic look at what happened at the CBI.
The governance at the CBI has always been sort of laissez-faire, old boys network. Rather than board members seeing it as crucial as part of their roles to run this organisation to make sure there is proper governance and complaints procedures, they just saw it as an add-on to their CV.
Because let's not forget, all the allegations published in The Guardian are just that, allegations. The CBI itself maintains to this day that it had no advance knowledge of any of the claims made by Anna Isaac in her second article. The only information the board had was what The Guardian had reported. Admittedly, the board was in a difficult position. What does due process look like when an organisation is faced with a full-blown media pylon? I spoke with someone who is on the board of a large FTSE company. They said their standard practice in dealing with anonymous allegations reported in the media is this. Don't respond to them at all. Don't even call them allegations. At this stage, they're referred to as media stories until the police get in touch. But the CBI board did not take this approach. Instead, it panicked.
Tony Danker, the Director General of the CBI, has just been dismissed by the employers' organisation with immediate effect.
The board did this, people with knowledge of the decision told us, despite having reassured him that he would be reinstated. We were told that right up until the board got wind of the second Guardian article, the general feeling was that Tony Danker would be rehabilitated. At no point was Tony Danker allowed to make his case to the board.
Now, he's going to be succeeded by Rayne Newton-Smith. She was, until recently, the CBI's chief economist. She's been brought back.
A week later, an extraordinary settling of scores takes place on primetime radio.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of April. Good morning.
The headlines this morning, the former head of the business lobby group, the CBI, Tony Danker, has told the BBC his reputation has been totally destroyed by his sacking, and he's been made a fall guy for a wider crisis at the organisation.
Top of the billing on the Today programme, a showdown between Tony Danker, the CBI's disgruntled former boss, and Brian McBride, its president. Tony Danker goes first and hits out hard.
I've been made the fall guy. Not did they just throw me under the bus, they reversed the bus back over me.
I'm listening that morning and almost missed my train to work. Here was a man who only weeks before had been the authority on matters of business. He'd been a staple on budget day and during party conference season. Now I was listening to him close to tears over his former employer. The Today programme follows that with an interview with Brian McBride.
I think Tony's description there was selective. Tony and I had a conversation when he was dismissed. I followed up with a legal letter explaining everything in detail. The board lost its trust and confidence in his ability to lead the organisation and represent the CBI in public. If any employee of any company in the UK feels they've been unfairly dismissed, they can go to an employment tribunal or they can take you to the High Court.
What are the other grounds?
Tony Danker duly goes on to sue the CBI for unfair dismissal. The bust-up on the radio will have repercussions for Brian McBride too. As the media circus intensified, more junior members of staff were feeling ill at ease. Something truly terrible might have happened at the place they worked, and no one knew who might be a victim or a perpetrator. Here's Grace again.
It was just sad. Everyone was so sad. The rape allegations were awful. There's multiple individuals living through all that. The absolute shit that those people went through. And then there was just a kind of real fear for the organisation. Real sadness. And also, I think a lot of women in particular were just not feeling very safe. Because it was, we were asking, you know, do these individuals still work here? And they, no one could give us answers around that.
To add to that sense of unease, on the same day that Tony Danker is officially dismissed, three other people, senior male figures, I'm told, are fired from the CBI.
So I don't even know if they were asked to leave or if they resigned. As the allegations came out within The Guardian, all of a sudden, three senior men were on long-term sick. So everyone was like, oh, it's you. All their diaries were blocked out, so they just said, they're sick. And then they left.
This episode got bizarrely little media attention, considering how much attention was being paid to everything else about the CBI. The names of these people haven't been made public. Neither have the grounds for their dismissal. The CBI won't tell us and says it has a legal duty of confidentiality to its employees. How serious was their misconduct? Did the police or the firm of HR lawyers investigate? Again, the CBI wouldn't tell us. What we've been left with is speculation. A week after The Guardian publishes the boat party rape allegation, Anna Isaac publishes a third article. It contains a second rape allegation involving CBI staff who worked at an office overseas.
So the first wave was fine. Some members started to talk about red lines. But the second wave, members did start leaving.
Staff were in an impossible situation. How do you convince members, the businesses that pay the CBI's bills and salaries, to stick around when you yourself are scared and in the dark?
It was hard. Part of you wanted it all to go away, because then you could just get on with it. And then part of you wanted to burn it down for those people that had been hurt.
Aviva, the UK's biggest life insurer, is the first to terminate its CBI membership. That's all it takes. The dam bursts and companies rush to cut ties.
NatWest, Virgin Media, BT, AstraZeneca, Ford and Meta, owners of Facebook.
The Telegraph runs a live blog announcing the departures as they come through. 50 firms in total that week pause or terminate their membership. To give you an idea of what that means in income, some firms pay as much as £90,000 for an annual membership. Multiply that by 50, and that could be as much as one-fifth of yearly membership fees walking out the door.
I was incredibly disappointed that so many firms that had worked with the CBI and been supported by the CBI and at times defended by the CBI over 60 years ran for the hills.
Paul Drexler was the president of the CBI from 2015 to 2018 and is the chair of the International Chamber of Commerce. He was appalled that so many companies fled the CBI so quickly.
The vast majority didn't and took the view it would be irresponsible to expose a whole organisation of predominantly young people at risk of their jobs and careers on the base of an incident that needed to be resolved. And I think the more responsible companies took the view, this is a not-for-profit enterprise, it's pretty small, it doesn't have any sort of balance sheet. If we discontinue membership, the risk is 300 people lose their job. That, to my mind, is not responsible business.
Many CBI staffers, past and present, look on in horror.
I don't recognise that sort of division from, you know, when I was there, it was brilliantly led by Carolyn Fairbairn. As I said, a lot of the senior leaders were female. There was a huge emphasis on diversity, on inclusion, on representation. A million miles away from the organisation that was portrayed in the media at the time of this incident. Unrecognisable to many of us.
Staff tried to mount a counter-narrative, posting supportive messages on LinkedIn.
As a proud CBI employee for over 10 years, I don't recognise this toxic or despicable behaviour, and my heart goes out to those directly affected.
During my 14 plus years at the CBI, I've worked with some remarkable, approachable and talented colleagues. The picture drawn by the press is unrecognisable from what I have experienced.
I spoke to former staff members who couldn't emphasise enough how brilliant their time was at the CBI. They pointed to specific examples, complaints that were handled perfectly, surveys of staff that tackled harassment or bullying, policies like extended maternity leave that were generous and forward-thinking. Many came out to bat for the organisation, but it would make little difference in shifting the narrative in light of what was about to come. 3 days after The Guardian's second rape story, the board of the CBI publishes a letter to its members. It's signed by Brian McBride. The letter talks about a collective sense of shame and complacency. It says the organisation failed to filter out culturally toxic people during the hiring process. It concedes the CBI has lost its voice amid the maelstrom. It's become relatively common for organisations to publish letters like these in the wake of a scandal. But the tone of this one sets it apart. If you were being charitable, you'd see Brian McBride's letter as an attempt by the board to draw a line in the sand. Hands up, confess all, and move on. But the basis for the mea culpa claims seem weak. The letter's claims don't match those in the Fox Williams report. Reading Brian McBride's letter, you'd think the investigators had found a litany of serious problems. But when I read the summary that Fox Williams released, it's far from scathing. It makes a number of rather mundane recommendations, like having HR represented on the board. It makes zero mention of how to filter out culturally toxic people. Between admit all and apologise and deny till you die, surely there's a middle ground. The Fox Williams report says the senior leadership at the CBI were not aware of the events in the press. The evidence actually suggested that when CBI management knew about wrongdoing, like the drunk man on the boat party, it dealt with it effectively. He was dismissed the next day. It also said there was no evidence of widespread drug use or awareness of this. As for whether those claims were true, including the two rapes, Fox Williams didn't investigate those. That wasn't in the brief. The City of London police were only just starting to investigate. Why, if you didn't have all the facts, would you think admitting full culpability was a good idea? Here's Paul Drexler again.
You know, it's always easy in hindsight, but no major public company would ever start out and say we're guilty of all charges without knowing whether they're guilty of all charges. And I think there was an overreaction to the challenge at the outset from which it was going to be impossible to row back from.
Last year, the boss of BP had to stand down because of multiple undisclosed relationships at work, and a BBC presenter was suspended because of allegations he paid a 17-year-old for sexually explicit photos. In those two cases, it's interesting to see how the organisations responded. In neither instance was it, yes, the press is right, and this is all true and we're very sorry. It's more along the lines of, this looks bad, we're going to investigate thoroughly, and we'll get back to you once investigations are concluded. Still, maybe there's an argument the CBI's board was right to err on the side of caution, especially given the seriousness of these claims. For Vivian Hunt and Anna Marks, both heads of professional client services firms, the exodus of CBI members was a warning shot that clients aren't afraid to walk. They were also both in the running for new jobs. They had to be seen as acting tough. Bludgeoned by story after story, the board was clearly starting to buy that something was wrong, culturally, with the CBI. In their eyes, a huge act of self-flagellation was the only way to restore its reputation. One source even described it as brave. But it's clear, in hindsight, that it also caused a lot of pain. After the letter was published, Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, came out and said there was no point engaging with the CBI.
I'm afraid they left it too little too late. And I think losing trust is so quick, easy to do, and then regaining it is so difficult. And their job is to represent business. They don't have the ear of government and they don't have the confidence of business.
The knock-on effect was the CBI was forced to slash a third of its wages bill. That summer, the organisation began cutting back its 300-strong workforce. Rayne Newton-Smith, the new DG, did what she could to steady the ship, implementing the recommendations made by Fox Williams and commissioning a cultural review by an outside firm called Principia. But the situation was dire. There was talk of merging with Make UK, another lobby group, and even a suggestion of renaming the CBI. Then, in June, an extraordinary general meeting was called, in which members voted on the fate of the organisation. They were asked, "Do the changes we have made and the commitments we have set out to reform our governance, culture, and purpose, give you the confidence you need to support the CBI. 93% of members cast their vote in favour. Under new leadership, it began to look possible that the CBI had put the worst behind it, that the ship had been steadied. A year has passed since the crisis at the CBI. Many thought, and some hoped, that it wouldn't come out the other side. But it has proved surprisingly resilient. Businesses are slowly coming back. The CBI says it's now back up to 170,000 members. Politicians seem to be back on board too. It even got honourable mention in Jeremy Hunt's last budget.
And today, following representations from many people, including the CBI, I announced measures to support the childcare sector make the new investment.
The CBI told Tortoise,
"We have put our heart and soul into these changes and worked hard to be at the heart of policymaking in the UK once more on behalf of our members. We are proud of our culture and the support in place for our people."
But now the chaos has passed, things begin to look a little different in the rearview mirror. For example, when Principia's review into the CBI culture was published, it concluded that blanket terms such as toxic or misogynistic were not an accurate or useful description. The CBI paid a high price for those labels. Its revenue slashed, the reputations of employees tarnished, and roughly 100 jobs lost. Something doesn't add up. Sure enough, it would turn out that employees of the CBI weren't the only ones caught up in the fallout. You might remember from earlier that one of the Guardian's allegations concerned a former board member.
I'm John Allen. I've had a long history of being on corporate boards for 37 years or so, and including having been president of the CBI between 2018 and 2020.
As well as being a board member of the CBI, John Allen was on the board of Tesco and house builder Barrett Developments. The paper alleged that he grabbed the bottom of a woman at a CBI dinner in 2019 and that he did the same thing at the Tesco annual meeting in 2022. It went on to allege that he had commented on a woman's appearance while at the CBI's November conference in 2019, and one claim came from a woman who worked for the CBI who said that Allen had made a comment about her bottom and what she was wearing. I asked him about the allegations published about him in The Guardian. It's the first time he has spoken publicly about them.
Well, look, it was a huge surprise that they had done this. I'd worked for over half a century without ever having any allegations of any sort of misconduct against me. I was innocent of the particular allegations they made, with one slight exception. During a conference, CBI conference, which was taking place, I think, down at Canary Wharf at the Intercontinental Hotel there. And during a lull in the proceedings, I was walking around and I noticed a woman looking a bit down in the mouth on her own. So I went up to her and to try and cheer her up, I said, "Well, that's a very nice dress you're wearing. It suits your figure very well." My intention was to cheer her up. Clearly, the effect was the opposite of that. I understand that she was upset by my remarks. She complained to her superior, who then told Carolyn Fairbairn, the Director General of the CBI, who told me. And, you know, I was horrified that I'd had that, created that impression. So I sought her out within 24 hours and apologized absolutely unreservedly. But the other allegations were totally without substance, and subsequent investigation and inquiries have failed to shed any light on them. To the Guardian have not produced any substantiation, and certainly I'm not, you know, guilty of what was alleged. I'm not a bottom toucher, frankly.
When the allegations came out, John Allen was asked to step down from the board of Tesco, and Barrett soon followed. He said to Tesco he was willing to step aside while they investigated. Tesco reviewed the CCTV footage from its annual meeting and even interviewed every woman who attended, but found nothing. Still, Tesco decided Allen had to go.
My theory is I think they panicked and felt they had to do something, and the only thing they could think of doing was to ask me to go. It's always valuable to have due process. You know, I was sentenced prior to any investigation. And that's clearly not the right way around.
Barrett's did even less. According to John Allen, the company never opened an investigation into any of the allegations, either before his dismissal or after. It took the Guardian report as gospel. John Allen was due to retire that year. The calculation seems to have been, oh well, he's unlikely to make a fuss. Tesco and Barrett's both directed us to statements they made at the time. Neither company has opened additional investigations into John Allen's conduct. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the boards were taking the easy way out. Accept all allegations as true, sack the person in question, and move on. It's another case of the details shifting in the rearview mirror. Decisions made in the heat of the moment that look more and more questionable as the storm subsides. A lot still isn't known. In the year since the CBI scandal, it's been reported that up to 10 NDAs have been signed by former or current staff at the organisation. It's not clear what they all relate to. The CBI told me they don't use NDAs to gag people from discussing their experiences or from reporting any misconduct or crime. But what about all those people who, for one reason or another, stopped working at the CBI? Why did they have to go? For Tony Danker, the reasons are still unclear. After being goaded by Brian McBride to go public with his dismissal letter, he never did. We don't know what aspect of his conduct, the karaoke comment, the Instagram stories, the texts, or the lunches, gave grounds for his dismissal. The three women who went to the press all left the CBI for jobs elsewhere. As for the three managers implicated in the crisis, they've never been identified, and chances are they never will be. Brian McBride announced he was leaving the CBI board last May, 5 months before his term was due to finish. Did he leave because of his role handling the first complaint? Or the culturally toxic letter? Four other board members have also taken their leave. Lord Billimoria, Dame Vivian Hunt, Claire Barclay and Anna Marks. The announcement said the need to bolster the CBI's governance structure has come through loud and clear during this period. Grace took voluntary redundancy in summer last year and has a new job. She's one of many former staff looking to put the crisis behind them. As for the victim and the perpetrator of the rape at that boat party, of the 11 cases the City of London Police initially opened, all but one have been closed without charges. They wouldn't confirm if the final case relates to the boat party or not. In the search for culpability, dozens of careers went up in flames, as did the reputation of the CBI. Some still presume that the allegations, ranging from singing at karaoke to rape, are all part of one toxic culture. The truth is more complicated. The boardroom, the place where calm heads are supposed to prevail, went to panic stations. Instead of addressing grievances by gathering evidence, it's succumbed to knee-jerk responses. How is that supposed to help create a sense of due process and justice in the workplace? The line between informal and inappropriate behaviour by the boss still isn't clear. There's no handbook for this stuff. And then there's the emotional running sore in all of this. That the most devastating and serious allegation has not been progressed at all. What happened on that boat? Thanks for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. And as ever, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do rate us or leave a review. This episode was reported by me, Barney McIntyre. It was written by me and Rebecca Moore. It was produced by Rebecca Moore. The executive producer was Jasper Corbett, and the sound design was by Dominic DeLaghi.
Tortoise. when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.